Hello and welcome to the Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Prospero. This week I'm on the beautiful wild Isle of Harris in the Outer Hebrides. I've driven through breathtaking scenery, think majestical mountains, white beaches and turquoise waters, to the south to meet a traditional apothecary who's carved out a unique place in the world of natural skincare. Amanda Sorin is the founder of a small batch distillery, AS Apothecary, making creams, balms, tinctures and scents from nature. She's a homeopath and a distiller and played a crucial role in the pandemic. Amanda and her team use flowers, bark, leaves, roots, blossom and moss grown or picked in wild fields, mountains and gardens here in Scotland and also in Sussex and Cyprus. Amanda, thank you so much for inviting me to your friend Caroline's gorgeous yurt to hear your story. I mean, give us a sense of what it's like to live in this beautiful remote place.
Harris is really wild. It's wild in every sense of the word. So where we live, you can probably hear the birds on the podcast now. We have seagulls, every kind of gull, corncrakes, just an incredible array of birds, and then the most incredible range of plants. So just up on the Macha, which is the kind of shale sand meadows, there's so many rare and beautiful plants to work with. And then in front of us we've got the sea, behind us we've got the sea. It's just magnificent, actually.
You were living in Sussex, and one of the questions I thought about you when I was jotting down a few notes is, you know, why here? And that's until I arrived. It's breathtaking. I mean, the beaches they look Caribbean-esque, don't they? Until you step into the icy waters. But what's even better than the Caribbean is the backdrop and the colours.
Yeah, the colours change incredibly. So at the moment we're sort of in the verdant green stage, but fairly shortly all the heather will be out. And so those hills all around us turn purple. So you've got this incredible turquoise blue sea, white sand, and then giving way to this sort of purple mountainous backdrop. It's absolutely magnificent.
Other thing that really struck me walking around here is you see the most inhospitable cliffs and then you spot a tiny, single, beautiful, fragile flower growing in the middle of what seems like rock.
Yeah.
How do they survive in such harsh conditions? Because sometimes it's quite wild here.
It is really wild. I mean, you're here on a summer's day and it's beautiful and calm and quiet and all the rest of it. But in winter, when the winds really get up, it can be 100 mile an hour wind. And you're walking along the road and it feels okay. And then suddenly it kind of, woof, it almost knocks you right off your feet. The gusts of wind are just phenomenal. So how some of these small plants survive is they come out now. So they go, oh, quick, it's summer, quick, everyone out. Then they dash to seed and then they die away, and in the winter they're back down in the ground again. So it's a perennial plant, so up in the summer and then away in the autumn.
You are an apothecary. What is an apothecary?
So an apothecary is it's a really old term, basically used for people who work with plants, who make medicines from plants. And that's been most of my working life, actually. So long before I trained as a homeopath, I'd been working with plants and herbs and all the rest of it. So apothecary is just the idea of medicinal plants, using medicinal plants. And I suppose traditional apothecaries like me, we go out and get the plants. So it's not about buying them in, it's about growing them or foraging for them or finding them and then using them.
And what's your story? How did it all begin?
Well, I trained in law. That was my degree. And then as soon as I'd finished that, I realised that I would never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, be a lawyer. I'd already had my son. And I decided that I wanted to have options for my children that were not necessarily allopathic. So just to have another strain or another option for treatment for coughs and colds and all those things that children inevitably get. So I started reading and working and training myself, really, I think. And I read prodigiously and then began to grow and collect herbs and then kind of carried on from there and did various things along the way. But plants, I suppose, have always been the backdrop to all of my working life, and making use of them, finding ways of using them for the benefit of other people has been an absolute passion of mine. And then years ago, we moved to Cyprus in 95 or something like that. When we moved to Cyprus, I met this woman called Maryam Khan. And Maryam Khan is a herbalist and a Sufi and a distiller. And I was in her house and she sprayed this spray and I'd never smelled anything like it. And I said to her, "What's that?" She said, "This is orange blossom and I've distilled it myself." And of course I'd smell orange blossom water, use it in cooking, but it was not like that. It was a different league of scent with multiple layers and complexity, and it was beautiful. And I said to her, "Have you got the still here?" She said, "Oh, yes, yes." So she showed me. It was this big old copper alembic, the really old-fashioned ones with the kind of onion top and the big wide bottom. And I said to her, "Will you teach me how to use it?" So over a period of years, we distilled together and still do distill together, apart from last year when it was COVID and I couldn't get to Cyprus. But when we left there after 7 years, I've carried on going back once or twice a year, just so I can do the distilling still.
And also, don't you use the olive oil from Cyprus too?
No, the olive oil actually comes from Crete. So my friend Kate, I'm blessed with the most amazingly creative friends. So my friend Kate lives in Crete for most of the year, part of the year. And her and her husband Vasily have Mesto Mountain, where his family have been farming olives for generations. And so when we were formulating a face cream, I knew that I wanted an incredibly good quality oil that was full of polyphenols. And olive oil is a brilliant, brilliant oil. Not the stuff you buy in the supermarket. No, no, no. But if you have someone grow olives for you and they pick them just before they're ripe and they cold press them in the old fashioned way, then that oil is unbelievably wonderful for you. And you know you've got a really good oil when you taste it, you get that peppery hit at the back of your throat. That's the polyphenols. And it's amazingly good for your skin. So I said to Kate, "Will you do your olive oil for me?" So I buy her olive oil and she ships it over from Crete, and I would only ever use that oil. It's magnificent.
So just stepping back in time a bit, did you start making potions and creams to cure things like eczema and stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, eczema and psoriasis are such a huge part of my working life. You see so much eczema and psoriasis. And what happens is people tend to put onto their skin creams that are petroleum-based. And so they can give the appearance of moisturising the skin, but actually they don't. They dry it. So it can look better on the surface temporarily, but actually it doesn't really penetrate the skin in the same way that other oils can do. So I started looking at which plants were particularly good for eczema and psoriasis, and then macerating this, so chopping them up into very small bits, putting them into oil, leaving them for several weeks, shaking it every day until the therapeutics from the plant had gone into the oil, and then using that oil to make balms and some essential oils as well that are just brilliant, absolutely brilliant for eczema and psoriasis. So yeah, that's why I did that.
Growing up, my mum occasionally was covered head to toe in psoriasis, and my grandfather, and I remember them being in hospital. And I'll never forget the smell of cold tar.
Yeah.
They were covered in cold tar and bandages. So they really probably needed
some
of your balm, didn't they?
They probably did.
They did. So is this how you eventually came to have the apothecary? Was it born out of making these remedies and creams and potions that were healing people?
Yes, it was, very much so. It worked so well, and I really love that side of it. I love the therapeutic side of it. And then I accidentally found myself in the beauty industry, which is weird and so strange for me because it's not really my natural habitat. But essentially, I'd been making all these lovely things and these creams and so on and so forth. And a really lovely woman from Content Beauty picked it up and phoned me and she said, "Can we launch you into the beauty world?" And I said to her, "Okay, then. if you want. So that's what she did. And so then we became part of the beauty industry, but not. So it's been an uncomfortable positioning, really, because I don't believe in all that rubbish about anti-aging potions. I think women's skin with lines on is fine. We've lived with it. We've smiled. We've laughed. Why shouldn't it show on our faces, you know, for goodness sake? So I reject all that side of the beauty industry, which is the hugest part of it. And my argument is, if your skin is healthy, that's what you want. Healthy skin, glows. So all the products that I make, I never talk about anti-aging. I can't stand it. All my products are all about having beautiful, healthy skin.
And am I right in thinking that your products you could spread on a piece of toast and eat?
You could, yeah. Might not be that tasty, but you definitely could. I mean, I always say to people, if you can't pronounce the things on the back of a jar, just don't put it on your skin. There's really no need. And things like, oh, I'm going to go off on a rant now, but things like hyaluronic acid drive me insane. So the idea that we have to keep plumping up and moisturising our skin with hyaluronic acid, no, you don't have to do that. If you have beautiful, fresh oils that you use in your skincare, if you've got fantastic quality plants and you know how to pick them, dry them and treat them respectfully, you will get every bit as good result from that as you would from hyaluronic acid or all the rest of that rubbish that the whole cosmeceutical industry is now offering with massive enthusiasm. But you just don't need it.
Funny you get me off on a rant now, because I try and eat without pesticides and stuff. But, you know, do I put chemicals on my skin, which is the biggest organ of the body, isn't it?
It's the most curious thing that we have women who come into, you know, the temple to the bakery and the deli, and, you know, they want organic products. Yes, and I agree, that's great. So our products are organic, so I understand that. And at the same time, you can see that the products that they use on their skin are not natural products. And you think, well, this is a weird old thing, isn't it? Obsessive about what they put into their body, but completely complacent about what they put onto their body. I find that a very strange mismatch.
Give us a flavour of the kinds of things you make in terms of face creams, balms. What sort of products do you make?
Well, we make all sorts of things. So my favourite thing that we make are our aromatic waters. So the aromatic waters, we pick the plants, I distill them. We make essential oil and the aromatic water as part of that. And those aromatic waters are just beautiful. So we do orange blossom in Cyprus. So we go and we pick the orange blossom and we distill it. I keep a still in Cyprus. I've got about 6 stills scattered around the world. So we go and pick. Mariam comes with us. It's actually in her garden where we pick. So we pick the bitter orange and we distill it. We make neroli oil and then this incredible aromatic water. And we do it with roses. So we grow about 250 roses of about 6 different varieties. Now in Yorkshire, actually it was in Sussex, but we've moved our rose garden to Yorkshire. So a friend of mine, Jerry, friend since university actually, she now is the keeper of the rose garden. So then we grow them in Yorkshire and then again, pick, distill rose water that is just, I mean, it's just magnificent. Because we often think of rose water as just a cooking thing, but really good rose water where you very carefully distill. It's not an industrial process, it's a very small process. The difference in quality is just staggering and the scent is just phenomenal.
What does one do with aromatic water?
You just splash it all over yourself. No, actually, in all seriousness, the rose, for example, is a really great product for calming your skin down. So women, especially menopausal women, where they're regularly getting hot, it cools your skin down. It's a beautiful product. And if you use an aromatic water before you put a face cream on, it helps the oil from the face cream be absorbed into the skin. So you really beautifully moisturise your skin. So the aromatic waters, I love. I love every one of them. And then we have things like balms. So we do a wild beauty balm, and that has a plant from up here in it, bog myrtle, which sounds awful. But if we give it its Latin name, it sounds marginally better, Myrica gale. And that's the most beautiful small-leaved plant. And when you break the leaf, it smells of gingerbread. It's really amazing plant. And it grows all over here, and it grows on my croft. So we distill that, and we get oil and an aromatic water for that. And it's the oil from that that goes into the Wild Beauty Balm, along with rose and various other things. And that leaves your skin beautifully moisturised and almost dewy looking. We've had a lot of models using it because it leaves their skin looking really dewy.
Roses, when you're talking about roses, as a little girl growing up in the north of England, we had really old-fashioned scented roses in the garden. And I used to spend hours getting all the petals and putting them in a glass bottle and adding water and then telling everybody I'd made perfume.
Yeah.
Yours is a bit more sophisticated than that, but I was quite interested in the distilling of the rose petal. Has the method that you use been handed down over generations? Are you using an old-fashioned method? What do you actually do then with them?
rose water and rose oil is made in Bulgaria a lot, but Turkey and Iranian rose oil is the best in the world. It's just, it's incredible. And they use a Rosa Damascena for theirs. So it's really one type of rose and it's magnificent. And because it's hot, it's full of scent, full of volatile oils. So in this country, we can't quite get that. We're not really of an Iranian temperature here. So
certainly not here, are we?
No, we're really not.
In Paris.
It's about 11 degrees. So what I found was that I do use Rosa Damascena because I love it, but I also use other roses as well. And I blend them together so that you get the scent of like a proper English rose garden, just that scent you're talking about, that old fashioned rose garden scent. So we grow the roses and then when they're in full bloom and looking absolutely magnificent, we snap the heads off. Which I have to tell
Sounds
you
brutal,
is joyful because all your life you're told not to pull the heads off roses. And then I used to do workshops down in Sussex, wild perfumery workshops, and we'd go out into the field where all the roses were growing. And I'd say to these women, go and pull all the heads off. And to begin with, they were really kind of cautious and sort of looking around when they were doing it. And then by the end, like wild abandon, just ripping their heads off. And then we bring them all in, pile them up on the table, and then we pull all the petals off. And that's actually quite an important part because if you leave any of the green on, it changes the scent profile quite significantly, actually. So although it's a time-consuming process, it's so magnificent. So we sit and we pull all the petals off and we have these stacks, I mean, piles of petals. And then quite often we just do face planting where we just drop our head straight into it. Oh my goodness me, that's a magnificent experience.
Quite like the idea of face planting into rose petals.
It's
I think
really
that'll
good.
That'll be next time I come and see you, I think. What about here? I mean, you must be in seventh heaven living here just from the wildlife that I've seen sort of over the last couple of days.
Yeah.
Do you use a lot of the mosses and the flowers from Harris?
The mosses less so. There's an issue about some of the mosses just because we have to conform to regulation about plants. There's lots of things I'd love to use, but actually you just have got to be a bit cautious. Some of the mosses anyway have been deemed to be carcinogenic, so we don't do that much with moss actually. I'm a little bit cautious about that, which is a shame, but it's a fact. Here what happens is we have some of the same plants that we grew in Sussex, but they're different. So then you come onto the whole issue of terroir. So in Sussex, where we grew meadowsweet, for example, it was about 4 foot tall, really tall, rangy plant, lovely white fluffy heads, beautiful scent. Up here, the same plant grows meadowsweet, but it's about 18 inches high at most, and it has a big, fat, thick stem because it needs to be solid against the wind. And the taste is different. The taste is definitely, definitely different. And the scent is different. And so what I find is that plants that I thought that I knew, here I'm rediscovering them again because actually they're different. Where we grew in Sussex, it was on an alkaline soil, south facing, very light loam. Here, it's got a pH of 5, so it's an acidic soil, it's heavy, it's full of water. And so the plants behave differently and the taste and the scent is different. Even the roses that I grew in Sussex that I'm growing here, smell and taste quite different. It's so much fun, honestly.
It sounds like you're constantly, always going to be on a learning journey.
Always. And that's the fun of it. I mean, that's the joy of life, isn't it? There's so much to learn. And the more you know you don't know. It's endlessly fascinating. And here, we've got space and time to really experiment. And that's massively good fun.
And how important, Amanda, is Mother Nature for our well-being, for our mental health, for our beauty? She says trying to avoid the word beauty, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
How important is Mother Nature?
It's phenomenally important. Really, really important. And I think that if you understand how you can use plants up here, more than anywhere I've ever lived, actually, it's like nature's larder. I mean, I can walk out and come back with 10 plants that I can use therapeutically or for the skin or for taste or to drink. You know, it's endless and it's so precious, but it's so fragile. And we have to be really responsible about how we treat this land. I was reading a thing in The Guardian yesterday about algal bloom and, you know, we're destroying the seas. They're just filling up with algal bloom, which kills everything that it touches. So I think we have to stop and say, instead of saying bigger is better, let's get bigger, 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 more, more, more. No, let's stop doing that and say, what do we need? Let's just use what we need. Let's be mindful about how we use the incredible plants and sea plants and all the rest of it that we have available to us. Stop being so greedy.
Your ranges are hugely successful. I love the fact that you're a small batch distiller. Mm. Have you been approached by massive companies trying to buy you out, which just to me would seem completely the wrong thing to do and probably against all of your better judgment in nature?
We've had some approaches and I say quite frankly, no, we won't be doing that. No, that's just a no. A lot of lovely small brands sell out to big companies, and I understand why they do it. They do it because they get a far better reach for their products, you know, far better sales, they make much more money themselves. And I find that's fine. And usually they're given some assurance that the products are never going to change, it's always going to be the same. That doesn't quite add up to me. It really doesn't. For me, I think the reason that I do what I do is because I can make a difference on a small scale, in a small way. For example, when I think about my business, we pay above the living wage to our staff. If people need time off, they can have time off. It's a human scale endeavor. And that's really, really important. And I think how much better to have human scale endeavors that don't, we don't make much money. I don't care. Do we make enough to pay our employees? Yes, we do. Do we make enough that we can live reasonably comfortably? Yes, we do. Fine. Well, that's good enough for me. We don't need year-on-year growth. We don't need to be expanding into something huge. We just need to carry on doing what we're doing, not being greedy, just being careful and cautious about the people that we live with and the plants that we use. That makes sense to me.
But also at the heart of what you do, it's all about, isn't it? You handpicking the orange blossom.
Yeah.
It wouldn't actually work on a massive scale, would it? You'd lose the whole essence of your business.
Exactly, right.
Just before we sat down, you poured an orange, peachy-looking potion and said this would help explain who you are. Shall we have a little sample of whatever's in front of us?
Yes, very exciting. Indeed. So here we have in front of us my drink. A lot of my work is now to do with drinks.
Oh, that's lovely.
It is yummy, isn't it? And I think this drink here really sums up what we do and why we do it. About 5 years ago, I started looking at non-alcoholic drinks, because a lot of our work is drinks. So I work with distillery making things for them, and Rathley Rum and Tidal Rum and Brighton Gin, and contacted by all kinds of drinks companies. And I love working with them. It's fun and they're great, but I don't drink. So I thought, oh, I'm making all these things for all these people, but there's nothing for me. I think I'd like to make a non-alcoholic drink. So I started playing around with different things. And what I realized was that the non-alcoholic drinks that have been on the market and are on the market now, on the whole, are just not nice. The idea that there's something that you drink when you're not drinking. No, it should be something that you want to drink because it tastes great all by itself. Not a negative, but a positive. So I started playing around with different ingredients. And when we moved up to Harris, I thought, okay, I'm really going to put some time aside to do this. So I did. And so in this drink here, what I wanted to get was the heat that you get from alcohol and the length, so that it has a lingering taste, that complexity of flavour that you get with alcohol as well. So I wanted something that was just satisfying and Moorish and delicious. So I started with seaweed. And I know you've been talking to Lewis McKenzie, who knows everything in the whole world about seaweed.
He does. What he doesn't know about seaweed, I don't think it's really worth knowing,
is it? I think you're right. Yes. I think you're right. So he dives for the sugar kelp for the distillery, but he also dives for the sugar kelp for me. So I thought, right, I'm going to put sugar kelp into this drink for that kind of umami flavour, that sort of salty, sweet thing. And the seaweed that Lewis dives for me, we dry that with so much care. And we've discovered that if you dry it outside on a washing line with Storm Force pegs,
don't forget your Storm Force pegs, essential. Otherwise your pants could be blowing across the lock.
I know, tell me about it.
Have you had that
problem?
Been
there, done that. Okay. Then was told about the Storm Force pegs. So what the seaweed seaweed does when you dry it on the line is it brings all the sugars to the surface and it gives it this incredible leathery texture. So I started with that. And then I thought, of course, I love roses. So I thought, okay, I'm going to put roses in as well. And then I needed a citrus. So I started to build this drink like a perfume. So when you make a perfume, you have a top note, a middle note, and a base note. But you need to have those three components. So something that's light and bright at the top, which is a citrus. Something which gives you the heart of a perfume, which is the thing that kind of carries it, and it's the thing that makes you feel satisfied, and then the base note that kind of comes in underneath, and that's the thing that gives it length. So I thought, well, why don't I apply perfume theory to a drink? So I did, and I made this.
It's absolutely delicious. I do like alcohol.
Thank you.
But I'd be very happy sitting out in the evening, chatting with you, drinking this.
The other thing I did with it as well, I thought, why do people drink alcohol? And one of the reasons is they want to feel relaxed and chilled. So I thought, oh, okay, then I'll put in adaptogens. So I'll put in some adaptogens which will make you feel chilled.
What are adaptogens?
So adaptogens are adaptogenic herbs, are plants that make you feel relaxed. They just take the heat out of everything. They just calm you down. And so in this one, there is ashwagandha, which is an adaptogen, and it's really calming. It makes you feel chilled. And chamomile that we grow up on the croft, of course. And we put in as well Avena sativa, which is oats. And oats are amazingly good for calming the nervous system down. So it has in it a whole host of plants that make you feel chilled. And it also has that heat and the length. It makes it yummy.
It is absolutely yummy. Now, whilst on the Isle of Harris, as you know, we've done a Convex Conversation podcast with Shona McLeod from the Isle of Harris Distillery.
Yeah, she's a lamb.
And also have sampled your drops in the gin, which were really delicious. So tell me a little bit about your work and the appetite for you to make things for drinks companies.
Yeah. I find myself in areas that aren't really anything to do with me. So I find myself in the drinks industry when I don't drink, and the beauty industry when it's not quite my thing. But it seems that I'm quite good at making drinks. So what happens with drinks companies, they usually have a conversation about how we could enhance the drink or give it something just to give it a little twist that's slightly different. And then all I need really is about a teaspoonful of it just to get an idea of the flavour profile. And then I start to work out what I can put into it that will make it more interesting. So with the distillery sugar kelp aromatic water, Lewis delivered the seaweed to me, and we tried drying it in different ways until we got to a point where we dried it. Oh, hello. Oh,
is that the cockerel?
Yes.
You never really quite know what's going to happen.
No, you really don't.
We've had a dog earlier, and that's the cockerel.
It could be a cow any minute now.
Exciting. And we're in a yard. Gosh.
Oh, yes, it's very chatty.
It's not 7 in the morning.
No, they did go on all day.
Did they?
So we dried the sugar kelp, and then I thought, okay, well, I'll try distilling this in the way that I distill. So we distilled it in different ways, so with more heat or less heat, and we played around with the temperature of the condenser until I got a product that I really, really liked. And what you get with the sugar kelp when you've treated it really respectfully is something that tastes almost like winkles. It's delicious. It's like the most delicious seafood you've ever tasted. It's not seaweedy. It's much more shellfishy almost, but in a lovely, lovely way. And so we discovered when we added that to the gin that it just gave it this lovely pop of the sea, like deep ocean pop of the sea. And then my son took it to a nightclub and found out that it's slightly phosphorescent as well.
How do you manage though to do that when actually you don't drink yourself? So is it just having a tiny taste?
Bit. It's a tiny bit. I don't drink because of any ethical problem. I just don't drink because I'm just not very interested in feeling tipsy. And I get tipsy really quickly. I mean, like mad quickly. So what I find is that a teaspoonful is really enough. I take a teaspoonful and then I can just get all the notes that I need, and then I can start playing around. And obviously we sample it as we go, but you'll have seen with the distillery one that it's a pipette, so I just need a few drops and then I can taste whether we're going in the right direction or not. And every drink that I do has many different iterations until I get to the point where I'm really happy with it. And that's often further down the line than the people I'm making it for. They're quite happy. I think, oh, no, I could just do this, or I could just change that. And I never let anything go until I'm completely satisfied with it.
And of course, being a distiller, had a wonderful advantage. You provided a very useful service in the pandemic with hand sanitizer, didn't
That's
you?
Right.
That didn't strip your hands.
It did
what
not.
What happened with the hand sanitizer?
So basically, in March 2020, I realized that there was a massive shortage of hand sanitizer and people in contact with me whose hands were stripped. I mean, shocking. I had photographs that just made me weep, actually, particularly of nurses and healthcare professionals whose hands were just, I mean, they were wrecked. So I thought, okay, I think I can do something about this. So I spoke to the distillery and arranged to receive ethanol from them, which I'm allowed to do because I'm a distiller and I have the right licensing to receive alcohol and store it. So that was good. So that was part A. Then part B was, because of course I have a skincare company, I understand about essential oils and oils in general. I knew exactly how to go about making something that was really good for your skin that we could add into the alcohol while still keeping it at 70% ABV, which is what you need to kill the virus. Then for every one that we sold, we gave three away. So I had calls from people who wanted some sent to their granny, or I had calls from care homes in Bournemouth. I had, at one point, I was supplying it to the helicopter air sea rescue service. I loved the idea of that. These beautifully moisturized hands rescue fishing people from the sea.
And the nurses and people like that, and police and people who were hand sanitizing all the time must have been eternally grateful for having something that probably meant they'd feel relaxed as well, because you used lavender.
Yes, that's
like
right.
That,
that's right. I did. I used lavender, mint and rosemary, and then some other bits and bobs that really make it really beautiful for your skin. And yeah, they were very pleased. I think the only sadness was for me, really, that when the massive amounts of commercial hand sanitizer came on stream, it was obviously cheaper than I could produce it. And so care homes started buying that in for their staff to use. So although we're busily giving it away still, which was great, I realized that there were still a lot of people, well, the vast majority of people, who were using pretty dreadful stuff on their skin. And I'm sad about that because it's a horrible cost. There was a nurse who wrote to me, and she'd actually had to stop nursing because her skin was so wrecked. So we sent her a load and it was improved. But I think the problem is that hand sanitizer, industrial scale hand sanitizer, is just revolting.
And probably causes far more problems than it actually solves.
Huge problems.
I'd just like to ask you about your special method of gathering, because it's slow and it's meditative process, isn't it?
It is. I mean, that sounds really naff, doesn't it? But
it is true,
actually. When you get in the zone, it's the most blissful thing. So we walk out, my team, I've got this great team up here. I had a great team in Sussex. I've got a great team up here. So we walk out and decide what it is that we're going to take. And we only take very small amounts. You would never know that we'd been there. And that's the trick. If you're foraging for something, it should be that nobody knows you've been there. You leave no damage. You never pull the roots up, all that kind of thing. So we fan out and then you just sit down and you're just slowly picking off the bits that you want. And it's blissful. I mean, it's really blissful.
I think you described it as like being in a small vineyard and only picking the grapes that you really wanted from each bunch.
That's right.
So everything's done with thought and care, isn't it?
It is.
And is it true that your husband won't go for walks with you anymore because you're too slow, because you're busy looking at everything?
Oh, I'm a nightmare. It's worse when we're in the car together and I go, stop, stop. He goes, oh no, I just have seen something. My head's row.
And how many people now work for you, Amanda? How big is the business?
It's still very small, actually. We've got, how many have we got up here? In Harris, we've got 5. And down in Sussex, we've got 10 in total now. We had more before the pandemic down in Sussex, but two of the women that I work with, who are very precious friends, both had underlying health conditions that meant that they really had to stop working. It was just, COVID was just all too much. And I really respect that. I understand that. So our Sussex team shrank, but now we have people in Yorkshire, Jerry in Yorkshire doing the roses, and then people in Sussex and people up here. So we're kind of spread out, but it's great. And they're really, really fantastic.
You talked about taste. What about smell? And have we lost a bit of that ability to smell and enjoy that kind of sensation?
I think we have. I think there's two things that have happened, really. One is we're bombarded by scent constantly now, and most of it is not from plants. It's actually fragrance oils. If you walk into most shops, I feel overwhelmed by the smell in them, and it's pumping out basically fragrance oils. And that overwhelms your senses, actually. It's quite overwhelming. And then I think the other part of it is that perfumery has changed. So when I was a child, I can remember my mum putting on perfume, and during the course of the day, she would reapply it. And it would change over a period of time as it kind of mixed in with her skin's own chemistry. But now in modern perfumery, that doesn't happen anymore because naturals aren't used anymore. It's all fragrance, and they put in phthalates, which are scent extenders. So the fragrance, you put it on at 9 o'clock in the morning and it smells exactly the same at noon, and you probably don't need to reapply it until 9 at night. So they stick to your skin, but it's not the natural scent. When you deal with natural scent, it's almost a visceral response that you have to it. So when you walk out into a field of roses and you breathe in that scent, you have an emotional reaction to that. And that's a fantastic thing. I mean, it's so exciting. When you put on a fragrance, a perfume, you don't have that. It doesn't affect you in the same way. And that's because one is plant-based and one is not. What I notice increasingly living here is when I go down to London for a meeting, the scent trail of the people walking in front of me, I can smell them 15 paces away.
It's not me, honestly.
And often it's like a cacophony of scents. So there's a scent that you use in your shower gel or your soap, and then your shampoo and your conditioner, the perfume put on, all the different skincare products that you put on, 5 maybe of those, your makeup smells, it all smells. Antiperspirant or a deodorant of some kind, that smells. So every day we're covering ourselves without even really thinking about it in all these different smells. And I think that really affects how we're able to smell generally. And I think that's very sad. I really do. Because when you're in the presence of a table full of roses or a table full of lavender, the plant itself, it's so amazing what it does to you psychologically. It makes you feel so great.
And do yours all work in harmony then? So if you've got your face cream on and your lip balm and you've splashed yourself with your rose water, Do they all work together to give you a lovely fresh smell?
They do. That's amazing. That was deliberate. So what I thought about when I was making the skincare ranges that I make is I thought, how can I make sure that each of these products dovetails with the other? So at the end of it, what you have is something really magnificent. Nothing fights. And that's really important to me. And they're natural scents, so that means that they go off after a period of time. So you're not constantly smelling. And when you walk down the road, you're not leaving this scent trail behind you.
I hope I don't leave a scent trail as I leave the,
no, I'm sure
the yurt shortly. What about sustainability, Amanda? How important is that?
That's incredibly important, isn't it? Certainly in the work that we do, behaving sustainably in how we work is critical. If you don't behave sustainably, you have no plants for the next year. I mean, it's a lesson for life, isn't it, really? Behave well, behave sensibly, act sustainably. Make sure that you have things that, you know, in the planting that we do on the croft or wherever we do it, we have plants that we put in specifically for the bees. Or it's about thinking about how do you nurture nature? And you'll only do that if you behave sustainably.
And were you aware of this growing up? I mean, as a little girl, were you aware of this kind of thing? Were you interested in plants and
wildlife?
Yeah,
I was. Well, when I was very small, we lived in Fife in Scotland, and our house was on the banks of the Firth of Forth. So I grew up with the sea in front of me. I think that's why I had to come back here. And I would go off as a child for long walks, picking and playing, much like you did, actually, making potions and things from mushing up things.
You wouldn't have wanted my rose perfume, by the way.
You wouldn't have wanted any of mine either. They're all...
It didn't smell like the actual roses on the bush, which was the plan.
It's like they're good for about an hour, those ones. After that, there's no...
No one comes near you when you splash yourself in my
really
rose water.
It's really the compost for that, isn't it? So yeah, I was. I always loved plants. I've always loved plants. And I've always felt very peaceful in nature, away from people. I love that. And here in Harris, I can walk out from the end of this road, which, you know, is a dead end, straight out onto the Macrons. It's an incredible meadow. And then there's beaches and there's the sea, and I can walk all the way round. And I rarely see anybody. And I love that. I love that so much. And of course, in summer, it doesn't get dark. So the first year that I was here and I needed roses and we weren't growing enough, and I thought, oh, what am I going to do? I realised I could raid people's gardens in the middle of the night because it was still light.
Didn't they see you doing
it? No, okay, it was Caroline's actually, and she was very good about it. She did say to me one time, hasn't been a very good year for the roses. I said, oh, no, it hasn't, has it? And I was thinking, they're all in my house.
I think the cockerel's telling us that it's probably time to wrap, and we can wander down to the temple.
We can.
Which is yours too, and have a cup of coffee, perhaps, looking out over the Mecca.
The sea
and the lovely turquoise waters and white sand. It's been a real joy chatting to you. It's just been amazing. I feel I've learnt such a lot. I feel quite tipsy on this, and it's non-alcoholic, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the adaptogens.
Is it? The adaptogens. Yeah. I'm feeling chilled. I'm feeling relaxed.
You're feeling adapted.
I'm feeling adapted. Thank you. And thank you to your friend Caroline for lending us her yurt. You've been listening to Apothecary Amanda Sorin chatting to me from a yurt in the south of the Isle of Harris in the Outer Hebrides. It truly is a magical place, and has felt a real treat being welcomed here. Don't forget, you can download and subscribe to our series at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or simply ask Alexa. I'll be back next week, somewhere not as beautiful as this, I'm guessing, a little closer to home with another great guest. So I'll see you then.